This is The Agency. I'm Candy Minx, and I'm in Chicago.
And I'm Eugene Napick, and I'm in Chicago.
We're both in the same room together. I can look at Eugene in the eyes. I wonder how this is going to affect how we talk. I think I'll probably not interrupt you as much because I'll be able to see your pacing. We can see each other.
Exactly. And we're at the Shadow Emporium Apothecary and Tea Room, which is located at 1628 West 21st Street in Pilsen. That's the south side of Chicago.
Yeah.
It's an absolutely gorgeous place.
Beautiful. We're
in a little room in the back. There's a hidden room to get here. There's a bookshelf that you have to open up and it reveals a whole back tea room. It's beautiful here.
It's beautiful. And we've got some paintings, black and white paintings. I don't know who's done it. It says Torres and it looks like from 2018. And they're just really fun, light touch portraits. I guess we can find out who did them. There's a cello. There's a little mini fireplace, gas fireplace. There's a photograph of Frida Kahlo, which is incredible. I don't think I've ever seen it before. There's burgundy carpet and burgundy pillows and Mexican-American, or actually probably really Mexican furniture in here, I believe. And a big burgundy chair, velvet. So there's a theme of black and iron rot and books. It's beautiful. It's the most adorable little room. Well, you can sit at least four people in here.
And we're recording today on my iPhone.
Oh yeah, that's going to be different.
We did a little test this morning.
That's right.
And the recording quality seems pretty reasonable. We're not going to have any of those characteristic Skype little blips that happen.
Yeah, right. And although I did use my phone last week, I had the cord in there and I kept holding it by the cord, which made weird noises. And so, we had breakfast with Stag this morning and we walked down, this is a few blocks from our house, and we had homemade scones and some coffee.
They're so yummy.
Good. And that's about it. Oh, I want to make sure that we cover our email. We would love to hear from you. Please email us at theagency.podcast@gmail.com. I've got a couple of events. I've got a Dish and Dharma potluck. And we're going to talk about consciousness and the nature of reality and anything else that comes to mind this Thursday, November 14th at 6 p.m. at 1151 West Leland. Everyone's welcome. You can bring food, but I'm going to make a big stew anyway if you don't get a chance to cook. But if you want to bring dessert or salad or something, please come.
And that's in Chicago.
That's in Chicago. Also in Chicago, at the same address, which is the Buddhist Temple of Chicago, 1151 West Leland, on November 26th at 7 p.m., I'm going to be hosting and facilitating a viewing of A Zen Life with D.T. Suzuki. And I'm telling you, it's Eric Fromm is in this, Alan Watts. You're going to have some classic Gary Snyder, the poet, our interviews, and it's a really good documentary. And I just wanted to put that out there.
Excellent.
Thank you.
Well, when we planned for me to come to Chicago on agency business, a few things happened.
Mm.
First thing that happened was I immediately got sick. I got like a super bad cold. My nose was running like a tap. It's a lot better now. I'm still a little bit stuffed up, but we have some Moroccan mint tea here.
Oh, God, it's really good.
From the Shadow Emporium, which is really tasty, and that's going to help with that. The next thing that happened was Candy said Mercury in retrograde.
Right.
The snowstorm.
Yeah.
So I was trying to decide if I was going to put my snow tires on my car for the drive. And I didn't want to put snow tires on for the drive if it wasn't going to snow. And I looked at the weather forecast several days ago and, you know, there was possibility of a little bit of snow.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, I don't know. And my partner Sheila said, I think you should put your snow tires on the car. And because she's usually right, I put snow tires on the car, which may have caused the storm.
Which
was the biggest November 11th snowstorm in the history of November 11th snowstorms. And I, of course, am driving to Chicago in it.
Right. And November 11th sticking out because it was Remembrance Day and Memorial Day in the United States.
Not Memorial Day, Veterans Day.
Veterans Day, sorry.
Memorial Day is, I think, in May.
And that's in Canada. Yeah.
So I screwed up my holidays. I mean to school you on your American holidays.
What we called May 2 for.
That's right.
Yeah.
Which is for Queen Victoria,
that's
of course.
Right. That's right. Damn monarchy. Which I love when it's in entertainment. The Crown. Okay.
So I loaded my stuff in the car and I started driving towards Sarnia. I thought I'd cross the border at the Blue Water Bridge in Sarnia rather than at Detroit. I think it's a little bit quicker, but also I don't like the border at Detroit.
Right.
And the reason why I don't like the border at Detroit is a few years ago, I was going to the mm-hmm. Midwest Banjo Camp, which is located in Olivet, Michigan, which is just mm-hmm. south of Lansing on 69. And I'd never been there before, and I crossed at Detroit, and I didn't even realize that half the roads that I needed were closed due to construction. But I got to the border, and the guy at the border said, "What's the purpose of your visit?" And so I said, "I'm going to the Midwest Banjo Camp." And he says, "What's the Midwest Banjo Camp?" And I thought about that for a second, and I said, "Well, that's where like-minded people with musical interests in folk music mm-hmm. gather together to play folk music together and learn to get better at it."
Sounds like weed to me.
And, well, yeah. So he said, "And where did you hear about this banjo camp?" So I said, "Well, on the internet, it's pretty well known in the old time music community." And he said, "When was the last time you got arrested?" So I started laughing because
big mistake.
You don't laugh at the border.
No, you don't.
It's one of those things you just don't do. You don't laugh at the border. So as soon as I started laughing, he said, "What's so funny? When were you last arrested?" So I said, "I don't think I've been arrested." And he said, "You don't think you've been arrested, or you haven't been arrested?" "I haven't been arrested. Can I have the keys to your car, please, sir?" So he went and he opened the back of the car and he starts rifling through all my clothing. And another guy shows up with a wand and he's waving this wand at my fenders. And I'm there for about 25 minutes while they're checking the car. He checked everything in the car except my banjo case. So when I got to the banjo camp, I was chatting with a guitar picker there and I was telling him this story. He was a guy from Detroit. He said, "Oh yeah, note to self, hide the drugs in the banjo case."
You know that you have just ruined the lives of every band traveling right now. They're all going to have, because, you know, I'm pretty sure we're very popular with the Border Control staff.
I'm sure they all listen to our podcast,
but I mean, oh my God. Well, yeah. But I went to Sarnia. I was always going across to Detroit for years. And then I don't know why I decided to see if I liked the Sarnia one. And it was shorter. It was a good half hour shorter than going through Detroit. And so much more pleasant. The roads and the driving was so polite. The people who drive on that highway, they follow the actual rule. They stay in the right lane unless they're passing.
It is a good route for sure.
It is.
Today, I get there. There's no lineup. Because it's a snowstorm, mm-hmm. and it was getting worse and worse as I got towards Sarnia.
And only fools would be driving.
Exactly. And, yes. And so I get there, and the guy says, "So what's going on today?"
Right.
And I said, "Going to Chicago." He said, "What's happening there?" Mm-hmm. And that's the kind of language he used. Mm-hmm. And I said, mm-hmm. "Visiting friends." He said, "Oh, all right. Well, I just got to tell you, we're expecting 6 to 12 inches of snow, and there's a winter storm advisory. Have a great day."
Oh, that's good. They don't want to feel like someone's going to die they've let you through the border.
It's a little...
Yeah. I'm sorry. Your partner doesn't listen to this podcast, does she?
Well, she's apt to listen to this, so she may know about the snow. God. So that's okay.
Okay.
So it was pretty bad after I crossed at Sarnia, from between Sarnia and Lansing. It was basically, the highway was drivable in one lane.
Oh, God.
It was kind of center bare in one lane. Everyone was taking their time. So it was fairly safe, actually. Yeah. But it was just slow. It was 60 kilometers per hour. And that's like, in American, that's what, 35 miles an hour?
Yeah.
So it was taking me forever to get there. And then I finally get to Lansing and... I had already been on the road 8 hours, hours.
That's just bizarre.
And it should be Lansing 5 hours.
I think you should have been here in 8 hours.
So I get to Lansing, and all I had was some cereal for breakfast. at this point, I'm getting pretty exhausted from driving in the snow, and I want a place to eat, and I pull off, and the only place I can see is a McDonald's.
No.
So I haven't eaten a McDonald's in years.
Right.
So it's not my kind of joint.
How was it?
Well, I figured the safest thing to try was like a buttermilk crispy chicken sandwich.
Okay. That does sound like the healthy choice.
And it actually wasn't bad. It was really kind of small, but it was crispy, and I'll say that. Mm-hmm. And it came with kind of those limp shoestring fries and a cup this cup. It must have been a 20-ounce cup. I've never seen a cup so big. This is ridiculous. Like, who could possibly drink a cup full of soda pop this big? So, anyway, I went, right. I got a little bit of something to drink, and I had my lunch there. Hit the road again, and I had some snow squalls after Lansing. Then it opened up, and I thought, oh, this is so good. I could actually go at a reasonable speed. There were two lanes that were relatively clear. And then I hit the bottom of Lake Michigan, which is it Benton Harbor? Is
yeah, maybe.
The town? As soon as I hit there, it was snow squalls. And I had to slow right down because the visibility wasn't too good. But the trucks, they don't slow down. They go whistling right by you. And because there's slush on the road, it was spraying up all this slush onto my windscreen. So for about 2 seconds, you see nothing while your windshield wipers
are... Oh, it's terrifying. It's happened to me. It's absolutely terrifying.
So it's a good thing it's important agency business that I'd be here. Because the 9-hour drive, typically, Toronto to Chicago, I mean, it could be 8.5, it could be 10, but it was 12.5.
Right.
And I was, fortunately, Candy had snacks out and scotch and beer.
That's right.
Which completely revived me.
Yes, it did seem to, it brought you new life. Well, you washed your face and then you came out and we had guests too. We had Michelle and Megan. Wonderful evening last night. You too, thank you so much. And they put up with us talking over and talking too much and doing what we do on the podcast in real life.
It was really a lot of fun.
It was really a lot of fun. And they got to tell us about their trip to Dublin and Ireland and Belfast. I actually think we maybe need to have Michelle come on the show and tell us about her tour.
I think
and
that would be
maybe
awesome.
Maybe she can prepare a little presentation or something.
Michelle, that's an invitation.
That's an invitation. And Megan told us about some great books, which I'm going to have to look into. That'll
and we'll be coming up. We'll post them on the Facebook page.
Yeah.
I wanted to also say about the drive over that two things. One is America has the best rest stops.
Yes, they do. They're incredible.
It doesn't matter on any interstate I've been on a regular basis, you can stop. And it's like every 30 or 40 miles. There's a place where you can pull over where there's spotlessly clean bathrooms. Mm-hmm. There's typically some forest around. There's places where people can walk their dogs.
And the buildings are retro. Sometimes you can see some historical trends in rest stops. And the architecture is often amazing.
It's something we can learn from up in Canada. We can do better with our rest stops, I think, for long distance driving. So I really appreciated that. And then at a certain point, you know, I had been listening to radio when I was driving in Canada, and then I just shut it off when I lost the radio station over around Sarnia. And I didn't really feel like listening to music. I wanted to just concentrate on the road, and I thought, well, maybe I could find some kind of talk radio. So I turned on the radio, and I found two evangelical radio stations followed by Rush Limbaugh. It's the scariest thing I've ever heard. It's no wonder Trump got elected for president with people out there. It's completely outrageous, making up stuff. It's wild.
Right. I've never listened to him. I don't know anything about a show. So that's kind of funny. I guess a little bit
to the right of, say, Attila the Hun.
Okay. Yeah, I figured he was. I never even thought I'd even check it out, but it's good that someone's reporting on that. I thought maybe he was going to lose. I thought he had a scandal a couple of years ago and he was going to be part of cancel culture.
He had an opioid addiction.
Oh,
but
okay.
I guess he recovered
from that. Okay.
Well, good for him for recovering from that.
True.
Although I'm a scary guy to have on the radio.
I wish he would have moved from opioids to ayahuasca or something and, you know, gotten a little bit cool. That'd be a great storyline.
I don't think he was going to get cool. I don't think there's any danger of him being cool.
No.
So I switched from Rush Limbaugh and I found NPR.
Oh.
So I found an NPR station, which is very much in tone like our CBC. All the announcers are very smooth and polished and speak with impeccable English.
Right.
Everything has a certain kind of pace about it. Quite pleasant. I really enjoyed it. But then I lost the NPR station as I'm heading west. And I searched around and I found NPR again. And when I found it again, because I guess the time zone changed, the time went back an hour, it was the same shows. It's like, wait a minute, I just heard this interview. So I had a choice between hearing the same things twice on NPR or evangelical radio or Rush Limbaugh, who apparently has like 5-hour shows.
Oh, wow.
It's just insane.
Wow.
Yelling at you for 5 hours.
Oh. Well, I often listen to a novel or a book, you know, a nonfiction book.
Or podcast. I should have really plugged in a podcast. That would be great.
Plug in a podcast. I mean, you got to pull over, do it at the rest stop, and get yourself set up and do a podcast. Exactly.
Yeah, there's some podcasts I've started to listen to. One in particularly I wanted to recommend for the folk music fans out there, Get Up in the Cool with Cameron DeWitt. Mm. It's an old-time music podcast. He has wonderful guests from the old-time community, and they play music together and talk about the music. Okay. It's really, really well done. Nice. Very impressive. So I want to give a podcast recommendation to Cameron DeWitt and Get Up in the Cool, which also has a fabulous name.
And I think I may have already said that I've been following Justin Long. Life is short. He's an actor and he interviews his friends and they are very good. Even when I don't know who the person is, I end up really enjoying it. I recommend the recent, I forgot his name, Neil deGrasse Tyson. I recommend his interview. That was like last week. Really, really good. The other one I want to recommend, now that we're talking about podcasts, is Dolly Parton's America. And I think it's an NPR feature podcast, 9 parts. And I listen to them in the car, too. And it's
really
fantastic. You really got to hear it. It's so good. The guy is interviewing her, playing lyrics, talking about the lyrics. It's very good.
We were talking last night around your kitchen table about Dolly Parton and how she's really an underrated songwriter, a performer with a really fantastic and unique history.
Definitely.
Someone that I dismissed growing up. I just dismissed Dolly Parton, I thought, because I would see her on like the Johnny Carson show all the time, and it just seemed like really cheesy stereotypes that they were promoting.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But later on, I discovered she's written some really, really great songs. And she also has a fascinating history. You know, she was with the country star Porter Wagoner,
mm-hmm.
and I think he really held her down, held
Definitely.
Her career back. And once she broke free of that, and people don't talk so much about Porter Wagoner anymore, they talk about Dolly, who's really become quite the entertainer in movies as well as song, but has stuck also to her roots and to... really quality songwriting.
Totally. Well, as a matter of fact, it's one of our listeners, an old friend of mine, Jenny, who recommended Dolly Parton's America. She's listening to it right now in Costa Rica. She's traveling, and she sent me a message about listening to it. So that's why I went out of my way. And in fact, I was a very intolerant, narrow aesthetic punk rocker at one point, and I did not listen to anything outside of that realm of music for about 6 months. And at some point, Jenny was really convincing me to listen to her lyrics and her songs. And her early albums, I mean, Jolene is very famous, and that's a beautiful, tragic, bittersweet song. But everything on those first 2, 3, 4 albums is abortion, women's rights, women's work, women's perspective. They are radical. The other thing is, in the old days, we used to argue about Bob Dylan. I said, well, Joni Mitchell is a female Bob Dylan. I'm absolutely wrong. The counterpart, the female counterpart to Bob Dylan is Dolly Parton. And I didn't really acknowledge
that. It's funny,
but
it's a better fit.
If we're going to argue about something like that and try to make an analogy or something, it's actually Dolly Parton. Anyway, I recommend that podcast. And thank you, Jenny, for telling us about it.
So, Candy, you saw Parasite. We talked about it last week.
I did see Parasite. And it's funny because I wanted to say something about it. It's so funny. Eugene was doing such a good job of not telling me what happened in the movie. But I accidentally or intuitively did guess a couple of the major things. We're going to do a spoiler. So if you don't want to hear about the movie Parasite, I think we're going to talk about it. So you might want to fast forward 10, 15 minutes. And we'll just try to get the worst part out, the most plot part out. But I do... Oh, go
or
ahead.
Or just go press pause, go out to the theater and see this one immediately, then come back and listen to us
talk. Yeah, because it is so good. That's right. Just come back. Don't listen to this episode until after you see Parasite. You have to see it. It's so fantastic. The one thing I want to say that was funny was that you were telling me about there's a family, they're wealthy, they start hiring people. And I said something like, well, do they live with them? And you went, no. But I knew it intuitively that they must live with them. And in fact, they do live with them. It's just not the way you think they're going to live with them. And the other thing is that you had described that they take over the maid. So again, I was like, I think, and when you said a whole new parasite is actually involved, not them, I went, it's got to be the maid. Because it turns out that it is a twist on the butler did it. It's the maid did it. And so I intuitively kind of guessed that just from, you know, when you do writing so, and that, you're going to start to guess it.
Here is the spoiler. We have the poor family all gets employed by the rich family who doesn't realize that the poor family are a family.
Right.
And they have this very curious symbiotic relationship in delicate balance where the poor family, the Kims, are... they're over the moon happy because they have all this income coming in and they're able to live a much better life than they ever could before. But the rich family, the Parks, are also very happy because their needs are, they're a very needy family and their needs are being met. And although they're being deceived, their needs are being met and it's hanging in a kind of delicate balance. And the spoiler is that...
well... They're working there. This part of the spoiler is that so they pretend to be friends. Oh, I know someone who's good at art therapy. I know someone who's a chef, a chauffeur. I know a maid. Come and get them to work. So they bring them in and they just pretend to not know each other, right? But the family is working is lived there, and there's a boy child and a boy child, a girl child and a girl child, and a mother and a father, and they're mirrored. In fact, some of the posters that I really like showed them mirrored. So you've got four family members working for four other family members. And then the rich family says, oh, look at the maid. You've got to stay here and look after the house. We're going on a camping trip. Would you say that was where it really gets kind of crazy? That's right.
They go off on the camping trip. And then party time starts.
Yeah. They take over the whole house.
They take over the entire house. And they just have a crazy party.
They're drinking.
They turn into a pigsty.
They've got the coffee table. It's a giant... expensive coffee table, and they've got chips and snacks and I don't know, whatever, pretzels or whatever the treats are, the Korean treats, and they've got booze and beer. I saw Sephora beer, and they are getting high. They are partying.
And then there's a knock on the door.
There's a knock on the door.
And the knock on the door is the maid who was fired.
Mm-hmm. And it's through an intercom, a video intercom too. So there's, you know, this movie does everything that film, it uses all the capabilities of film without the crazy special. Obviously, there's special effects.
Oh, and but, for those who didn't tune in last week, this is a South Korean film, filmed in Korean with English subtitles. I should say that. So the what we learn is that the maid has a husband who's been living in the basement, in a secret room in the basement. And it's funny because we're in a secret room in the Shadow Emporium today, talking about a secret room in the basement in The Parasite. And her husband has been living in this room. And there's a telltale bit of dialogue at one point when the Mr. Park is talking about the maid, saying, you know, she was a pretty good maid, but she really ate a lot. Because, of course, she was smuggling food for her husband, for her husband who was living in the basement. Yeah. And he's learned that he taps like a power switch in Morse code. And I think that the young kid is hearing the Morse code. And he's a Boy Scout, so he knows the Morse code. So I think that the little kid is sort of hip to the...
that lives there, yes. And he is traumatized because he sees a ghost. And the camera, there's a pantry where the hidden doorway is with the shelves. And what we see is all of a sudden this head rise up from the basement. It's a panic room. A panic room hasn't been so well used since the movie called Panic Room. Basically, that's where his family, the secret family, is living. The third family, the husband and wife, are living in the panic room, which is fully stocked.
Where the husband is.
The wife husband goes, is. The wife she goes home, back and forth, yeah.
And he's, she goes continues. Home. He's been living in this basement for 2 years.
Right, but it doesn't make sense. I don't see why she doesn't sneak the food out to him. But it doesn't matter. But I mean, there must be a reason why he's living there. It's easier to get the food to him?
I guess.
I guess so.
So he's this other kind of parasite living on the family, literally living in this panic room in the base. I can't believe I said literally. I said literally. It's my pet peeve, people who use literally, and I've said it.
Mea culpa.
I know. Hey, mea, you know what? Culpa. Am I wrong that I was totally exhilarated watching this movie? I felt like I was, you know, I'm going to take my horse to the old town road and I'm going to ride till I can't no more.
Well, I think part of it is the way he structures the movie. The first half is... it's crazy funny in the way the Lucy show was crazy funny. Mm-hmm. It sets up situations which depend on the cleverness of the writing for their humor, and you're always worried that everybody's going to find out what's going on.
Yeah.
And so it's laugh out loud funny, and it goes. As soon as the old maid comes back,
right, knocks on the door.
Knocks on the door, then suddenly everything goes to hell.
Yeah, it's absolutely terrifying.
It gets completely dark after that.
Totally.
And dark in the scariest ways. So you're already exhilarated from the humor of the first part.
Right.
And then you're plunged right into this darkness. Right. And it's all new and it's clever and it's ingenious.
Right. I also really loved it. Like, you know what? It's like if you read Hamlet and then you read Hamlet and you realize it's not really about everybody dying, it's about rebirth. And I think part of my exhilaration is that at some point, even it does play out a little bit like a tragedy of Hamlet, and yet I felt exhilarated because I felt like the world was reborn. Their universe was reborn in some way. And I you know, yes, people die, but there was something that was more truthful. And then again, it just reverts back to that their only option is to accept that if you're going to be happy and have peace of mind, you have to be rich. That's the only way you can be peaceful in this world.
I read an interview with the set designer for this film. And I'm sorry, I don't have his name here. Okay. I had written it down at home, right, and I brought a blank notebook with me, which is very helpful.
Yes, I can see if I can Google it while you're saying your thoughts.
It's a very interesting article because he talked about how the sets were constructed. And both, there's basically two sets of sets. The one is in the poverty-stricken area,
right,
and the other is in the Parks Mansion. Right. And the Parks Mansion was, they say it was designed by an architect.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's very she architectural, and it's huge, and everything is clutter-free.
Mm-hmm.
In the areas that are rich, everything is clutter-free. Everything has smooth textures.
Mm-hmm.
The floors are the smooth hardwood floors. Everything is just so. And there's a room in the house, which they built this house for the film. There's a room in this house which has a window, which is the entire wall of this huge room, and it looks out to the outside.
Right.
And one of the things that they keep repeating is that in the areas where there's wealth, there's more access to the sun. And in the poor areas, you're always going downstairs, down, 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 into, it's almost like in catacombs.
Right.
And the set designer said in this interview that there are areas in Korea that are like that, but they had to build their own because there's some flood scenes in there that are really spectacular, and they didn't want to have to flood an actual neighborhood.
Their name is Lee Ha Jun, and the cinematographer was also incredible. Hong Kang Poi, also just in beautiful cinematography for the content. Yeah, and I did see that right away on Wikipedia that he said that he designed the house to fit the sun, the movement of the sun.
That's right. And as well, at the same time, they took into account where they needed to have cameras.
Right.
So they built it around how they wanted to film it. And so you see this incredible dichotomy between the area where the Kims live at the beginning, which is totally cluttered. There's no space. Mm-hmm. It seems like it's in like a semi-basement.
It seems filthy.
It's very filthy.
I don't know why, but it seems like
all the textures they made, they thought about the textures, they made all the textures rough.
Yes.
Nothing is really smooth and elegant.
Right.
And as you go up in class, then you see the smooth textures and you see the sunlight, you see less dense space, it's more orderly.
Yeah.
Everything is orderly. There's less clutter. But then within the Parks house, You go down into the basement where the first maid's husband is living, mm-hmm. and it's very much like how the Kims were living.
Oh, it's ironic. Totally ironic, yeah.
You know? Because the stairs are the gateway between the two classes.
Totally. And I, you know what's funny, though? I really did love the Kim's family, the poorer family's house. I kind of loved it. It was chaos. There was seemed to be, like, you know, all their junk was around. But they had created this bathroom where, in order for the plumbing to function, the toilet was on this at least a four-foot-high pedestal. Yes. And they had to climb up these tiled stairs to use the toilet. And when their Wi-Fi runs out, the only place they could find the Wi-Fi reception was by this toilet in a little window.
And that's right, where they're stealing from there. A cafe.
Right, right. And it that was really funny that their autonomy was their Wi-Fi at that point. You know, their freedom was their Wi-Fi.
And at a certain point in the film...
Oh, here comes some more tea. Thank you, our beautiful hostess. Thank you.
You're welcome.
It's really good tea.
Tea is really good.
Oh,
it's amazing. It's so strong. I love it. It's so fresh.
Yes, and it makes too. So it's
good. Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you. Much. Thank you so much.
So at a certain point, when everything starts going to shit,
mm-hmm.
There's a storm. Mm-hmm. And it's not just a storm.
No.
It made the snowstorm I drove to Chicago in small. It's I mean, beautiful. It was a deluge.
Beautiful.
And there were these incredible flood scenes as the Kim family is walking back home through water that's just flowing down stairs and down roads. And it's in some areas, it's up 4 and 5 feet. And there's all these objects from personal lives floating around in the deluge.
Oh, God.
It was an incredibly moving scene.
Right. And then the scene when they leave their apartment to go to the shelter, they go to a common room like an auditorium. It was heartbreaking. Absolutely heartbreaking. I mean, Stagg said that he felt choked up. He was going to start to cry or something. It was really upsetting. And then the scene changes to the rich people's apartment, the house. And she goes, oh, it's such a beautiful... It's the next day. She goes, it's a beautiful sunny day. Let's have a party. There was no consideration at all what the rest of the city had suffered through. And that it was just a bad rainstorm to her.
That's right.
That they had to cancel their camping trip.
That's right. They came home early from the camping trip in typical kind of Lucy Show type fashion.
It becomes Lucy Show, but horror filled.
Oh,
it feels like a horror movie. I don't know why.
The woman of the house, Mrs. Park, mm-hmm. calls the maid and says, oh yes, we'll be home in 8 minutes and we want some noodles.
Yeah.
Put the noodles on. And you look around at the house and they've turned it into a complete wreck.
Yeah.
And they've exposed the fact that there's another parasite in the house, mm-hmm. and they have to clean everything up
mm-hmm.
in 8 minutes and have noodles ready.
Right.
And somehow or another they do it.
They do it. Yeah. And, you know, then the movie wraps up at some point. But the thing that was interesting is having seen Widows, which we talked about last week, is there are two creative people who have taken a very similar concerns in completely different countries and how they've dealt with it. And they've put it into a genre, their own genre. One, a heist film, and then, I don't know what this would be called, a suspense. It's sort of a thriller, really.
In a way it is. It's it's nothing like any other film I've seen
right.
before.
Well, exactly. It's like, well, I think in some ways it's like Swept Away, the old Lena Wertmüller film where there's a class struggle and they're trapped on an island, but that's a castaway story. It's right. not, you know, it is a parlor thriller. It is like Agatha Christie and it is like a parlor mystery. The butler did it. And there is all of that in there. So they're kind of wrenching around with that.
The idea that a parasite infiltrates the host is...
Mm-hmm.
It's a very strong idea, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And you don't really see it that way. I mean, you get it right away. Okay, this family is going to kind of take over and live off the rich family, the Parks.
Mm-hmm.
But when you meet the old maid and her husband who's living in the basement, it really hammers home the idea of the parasite infiltrating the host and living off host in this kind of relationship that everyone's
right. Okay. But the thing is, there's no reason for it to be like that. It's only because there's rich and poor. And so is it such a bad thing? That's why I found it kind of you know, I'm oddly invigorated by the movie because at least more people were eating off of that family. So that goes back to Downton Abbey, that would those, the working people, would they have any kind of life? But we need to tax the rich. That was my feeling when I left. It was like, tax the rich. We need to balance this out.
What did you think of the little boy in the Park family who was, Mr. Park says, really into Indians? Mm-hmm. And they wanted to please the child by allowing him to have his bow and arrow and mm-hmm. And stage an Indian ambush.
Well, I guess that it goes back to Cormac McCarthy when he wrote Blood Rooney. He said everybody likes the Old West. And so he knew when he did that genre, I think he must have been thinking he could get international readers, which was in fact true. And everybody does like the Old West. I guess the little kid, that's where freedom is. I thought it was also about cultural appropriation. But was it? I don't know. I mean, in a way, genre is, every time we do a genre, we're culturally appropriating that genre, and we're putting our own shit on top of it. So there's that.
There was an attitude that was shown in the film a few times from early on mm-hmm. that, well, if it's from America, yes. it must be good.
Yes, yes.
And I don't know if that's prevalent in Korea or not.
That I don't idea. Know either, because the tent was made, his teepee / tent was made in America. So they said, don't worry, it won't leak. But they did say that a couple of times. And it wasn't the only time that there was a reference to Native Americans in the film. It came up at least 3 times in the movie, I believe. I've only seen it once, but I thought it came up 2 or 3 times. Which I found kind of jolted me. I wasn't sure how to feel about it. I was like, "What is this a joke? Does this mean something?" So I think it does mean something, but I don't know what it meant. I haven't figured that out yet.
The other situation I thought was very curious was when the elder son of the Kims, mm-hmm. I'm sorry, I don't remember his mm-hmm. name, he's approached by his friend who wants him
at the beginning of the movie. Yes,
wants him to be the tutor because he trusts him.
I know.
Because he wants to marry eventually this girl that mm-hmm. he's tutoring. Mm-hmm. Well, it doesn't take more than one visit to the house before this girl and this guy are
right.
kissing.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's like Great Gatsby, too. Because he does fall in love with the girl that's actually better suited, culturally class suited to his college friend. You know, who I assume must be an upper middle class kid who's friends with the poor kid. I don't know. Or has he just changed his...
It's not really explained.
It's not clear, but he wears a suit. But there was a Great Gatsby kind of feeling for me, too. And it definitely ends on that kind of note that Great Gatsby might be showing up in the future of South Korea. That kid's going to do what he can to get that lifestyle. Great movie.
Down the stairs into the Kim's world mm-hmm. reminded me a little bit of visiting Hanoi when we were there, in that it's a town that has main streets and then alleys that are almost like catacombs. Mm. You go into these alleys and it's like a whole other world. Mm. You walk along and then suddenly it gets very narrow and it gets very dark and you think, should I even be here? And then if you go a little further along, it opens up and there's somebody barbecuing pork. There's somebody making soup.
Right.
Right. And they've got little chairs and there's somebody selling beer. And this happens in spots where in Toronto or in Chicago, you wouldn't dream of going to look in a back alley for lunch.
But you know what? I've seen people do it in their front houses in some neighborhoods in Chicago. Maybe I don't want to say what those neighborhoods are. But you definitely can find street food done from someone's home walking around Chicago. And it's usually fantastic. My sister was here and Zach was here, Kiki and Zach, and at different times. And they're like, well, why do you even cook at home? And I said, I know, because it's such a great price and it's delicious and it's homemade.
And so, this reminds me of your discovery, and I think we should talk about it. We need to talk about street mango.
Oh, yeah.
We need to talk about
street mango.
Okay, first of all, here in Chicago, in the area in which Candy and Stag live, there are places on the street where you can buy a mango.
It's a street cart. Yeah.
It's been cut up and it has...
The mango, not the cart.
The mango. And it has, I guess, salt and lime and chili.
Oh, yeah.
And it's so, so good. It's intoxicatingly good.
It is intoxicating.
And I've got home and I've tried to replicate it. And I can do street mango that is good, but it's not the same.
Right. And so I found out at work, someone had brought in mango, one of my coworkers, and they brought in this curious shaker. I can't, what was it called? Tajeti or something? We got to track it down at one of the corner stores. And it's a freeze-dried lime and chili mix. So we were doing all that we possibly could at home to try and make this when it actually was
a commercially bought product that you shake on the mango.
Yeah, yeah.
Which it's always tastes the same at every cart because everyone has the same shaker of stuff, yep, I think.
Exactly.
Man, I love that mango.
Oh, I know. We might be able to find some today.
Street food in general, you know, I love street food. In Toronto, somebody had the idea that, you know, Toronto needs to have more street food. And so we're going to license street food trucks. Mm-hmm. And city council got involved with it. And we've got a dysfunctional city council. It's amazing they can get anything done. And they created so many rules around these street trucks in terms of how the truck or the cart has to be, what hoops they have to jump through to get the license, where they can go. Mm-hmm. And they've basically put so many rules on it that there's no way these businesses are going to have half a chance at succeeding.
Right.
You know, whereas places where street food is king, and I bring up Vietnam again, I mean, Hanoi and Ho Chi Minh City or Saigon or Hoi An or so many towns throughout Vietnam, street food everywhere. And I mean, it's the Wild West. There's no rules. And one of the first things you notice is, well, there's no refrigeration. Mm. Is that good? Mm-hmm. And you realize, well, everybody eats here. Nobody gets sick. Maybe that's okay.
Yeah.
Plus, everybody buys everything fresh at the market in the morning and sells it out by the end of the day and goes home once everything is sold out, closes up. Mm-hmm. So it's a different kind of way of looking at food. You know, you don't have food sitting around in the refrigerator. Yeah. You buy what you need, you cook it. But there are no rules. There are no inspections.
Allegedly.
Oh, and you know, we were just talking about Parasite. Yeah. There are food vendors in Hanoi, for instance, who don't have an official license, who just show up and start barbecuing on the street. And they claim a corner or a spot. Mm-hmm. And they bring their own blue plastic furniture, which we would call kiddie furniture because it's so tiny. I know
exactly what you're talking about.
And little tiny little tables and little tiny little chairs. I toppled off one, actually, in Saigon. I just fell off. And everybody thought it was pretty funny with me, lying on the sidewalk.
Yeah.
Because I'm a pretty big guy and it was a very, very small stool. Although I did learn, they showed me that for bigger people, you stack four or five of these together and you make a bigger blue plastic chair. So some of these people will be very portable, and every now and then the cops will come and basically take away their stuff, they don't get back.
Oh,
yes, really? Until they pay the fine.
Oh, wow.
So they have to pay the fine.
They're paying a fine for not having a legal food vendor?
That's right. And they won't be able to get the legal license.
Right.
So there's some people who have a building who can have their fur shop in the building selling their soup or whatever, and they can live above it. And then there's other people who just set up on the street.
Crazy. Okay, I see.
And every now and then the cops will just you know, clean house.
I thought of something else about Parasite, is that we've said, okay, that this family comes into these rich people's houses. I think there's a third Parasite, and I think it's the real Parasite. It's the rich people.
Go on and explain.
Well, because we think that, why are they entitled to have those possessions? They earn them, they work for them. So you've got the people that go into the house and take over the house and lie about their identity,
they're the first parasite on society.
They're the first parasite. And then the second parasite is that we find out the maid actually had her husband in the basement. And I'm saying that the third parasite is the people who are using people just because they're poor to have their livelihood. They're sucking the energy of the poor people.
They're the parasite on society,
yes.
Who depend on
the hard luck of...
Yes, who depend on people who live in poverty right. for their own, to live in their own wealth.
Who will do anything. Of course they're going to clean your laundry and cook your food and do all the shitty jobs you don't want to do because they've got nothing else to do. And so I think that there's That's a little true. Twist on that, that yes. the real parasite is, I think the punchline of the whole thing is that it's the rich people that are the parasite. And that's why I think I had an elation, a totally euphoric thing, because unfortunately people do die. You know, there is some death in the...
And every
good
story. It's brutal death. The way it's done pulls no punches. Right. It's sudden and brutal. Right.
Totally. And so I think that you know, that to me is that there's really, at the end of the day, the parasite is the structure, is the way that they're making money.
The social structure right. allows the rich parasite right. to infiltrate right. the society. Right.
And right. the parasite thing is, you know, we're parasites. We're parasites every day. Do you think marijuana, weed, would grow the way it did if we hadn't been cultivating in it and involved it? We have a relationship with weed. We've made it a more important... The little poison it had to keep its bugs off or keep humans away actually made us have a symbiotic relationship to it. We grow it like crazy. It was probably never designed to grow that much.
That's true. And
same as corn.
As well, it's grown to have a higher THC content. So... Right. You know, it's grown to produce the maximum amount of buds right. and as little leaf as possible.
Yeah. And we've done that. So we're parasites on marijuana in a way. We've got this sure. relationship with it, and now it's more successful.
And we do that with so many different
plants. All of our different stuff, plants. For sure.
You know, for instance, I don't know if you realize that if you go into a grocery store and you want to buy some mushrooms, and then you see they have the white button mushrooms, they have the cremini or the cremini mushrooms, yep. they have the portobello mushrooms, yep. they're all the same species of mushroom.
Mm.
So they've just been grown to have certain qualities, mm-hmm. but it's the same species. Mm-hmm. Whereas mushrooms in the wild, they'll take on whatever their natural form
right.
is.
Right. I'm going to change subject here. I watched something else this week. I was looking for something on Netflix, and I think I went to go watch... Oh, I went to go watch more movies by the director of Parasite. And I started watching this movie called Okja. And at the first few seconds, all of a sudden, I saw a pig, and I realized, I can't watch this, because Michelle and Megan had watched it a couple years ago, and there were tears. It's a very depressing story about this little pig. So I had to stop watching it. And the next thing that popped up was recommended for me to watch. I guess they read yes. what you watch, right? And the thing that was taking over my screen was The Devil Next Door. And I thought, you know, maybe I am interested. What is it? And then I saw it was Nazis and Nazi hunting, which is one of my passions. Did you know, do you remember I saw one of the last Nazi hunters a couple of years ago? I went and saw him speak publicly here in Chicago. Yeah, it's an obsession I have, one of my little obsessions. Part of me wishes, why didn't I grow up to be a Nazi hunter? I don't know what happened. I guess it's that feeling of like you want to get justice. Anyway, his name was Ephraim Zuroff, and I saw him speak in a suburb of Chicago. And I thought about him because I ended up watching this 5-part series, binging it. I had to watch the whole thing. It's about the guy who was in Cleveland and gets arrested in the 80s. They figure he's Ivan the Terrible. And so he goes to, how are we doing? Is it still recording?
Yes, like we're just looking at the phone now. Yep. I just pressed the little button. And
making sure we're still going. And I know I'm changing the topic to actually a different topic.
I didn't mean to interrupt you, though.
No, that's okay. So this Netflix special, I highly recommend everybody watch it. His name was, I'm not sure I'm going to be able to say it properly, John Demjanjuk. I think I just ruined it. John Demjanjuk. Anyway, he was moved to United States, came here in 1952, started his family, worked at the Ford plant, lived a very, very good life.
I've read about this story.
Yeah, I remember when it came. I was following it as it happened. And at first I thought, well, I don't need to watch it because I already know this story. But then I thought, no, maybe I do want to watch it because it had twists and turns, much like Parasite. So it was very, very effective documentary. He gets hauled off to Israel. And I was very excited because I'm like, take this guy, get him. And it turns out maybe he wasn't Ivan the Terrible. They show the court case, they show the witnesses, they're extremely believable. I mean, when one guy walks up to him and he looks him in the eye, he knows it. But it turns out that there's also SS documents. The lawyer that was defending this purported Yvonne the Terrible. He said, I don't believe SS documents. Why would I take those as being serious? That's the, those guys are bad. They're Nazis. I'm not going to take them as telling me the truth. However, he also didn't like that the witnesses who were survivors, he didn't believe their account. His lawyer, the scene, this lawyer is a very interesting story. All the people involved are fascinating. Whether you like them or not, they're super amazing. And they do interviews now, looking back on the case. So that's okay. Pretty interesting. Okay, so it's made now with these lawyers nowadays. And then they have film clips, archival footage of the process. So basically, he appeals, he is found guilty of being Yvonne the Terrible. But once the wall goes down in the Soviet Union in Berlin, more KGB documents are made available. So they go and find them, and they find accounts that the fellow was actually brown-eyed. They find all these reports, and now the lawyer defending this guy, he says, oh, I do like those documents by the SS. They're fine. I'll use them. And he gets released because of reasonable doubt. So it's a terrible, terrible tragedy, and it's very confusing. Then we come up to the current day lawyers, and he's saying, well, we had these documents where he came into the United States and he put his maiden name as Marchenko. Yvonne the Terrible was even Marchenko. So is this a coincidence? Is it possible he would have these two names on his documents coming to the United States? So it goes right back to chills down your spine that he is this guy. Meanwhile, someone finds documentation that he worked in the camps. He gets taken back to Germany. This is years later. He goes back to the United States. He had his U.S. citizenship revoked. They gave it back to him. And then it gets revoked again, and he goes to Germany, and he's on trial there, and they prove that he's a different, possibly the same guy, but they prove that he had worked in several concentration camps. Wow. And he's the first person that they were able to arrest and convict who had not been one of the leaders. They always said, well, if you're aiding and abetting, maybe it's not so bad. They kind of let people go while it was a war. This was the first time that they said, no, you are going to pay for this. He appeals it and he dies. He's technically innocent because he died during the appeal. And the German law says that you cannot hold that on. Anybody in Germany, maybe you guys can tidy this up for me. Write us a letter, let us know. I'm probably screwing this up, but I highly recommend this. The twists and turns, even though I've talked about them, it's such compelling footage, and the lawyers are fascinating. They're so interesting. One is kind of the bad guy, and there's two or three that are the good guys, and then there's a son-in-law that wants to defend his father-in-law. He marries his daughter, and then there's all the racism. There's all the anti-Semitism that happens surrounding this too, saying you're taking our innocent guy from America. He was my grandfather. He was my neighbor. He's so nice. How could he be this guy? Very interesting.
It sounds really interesting.
It's fantastic. And Ephraim Zuroff, who I saw speak as one of the last Nazi hunters, he's an incredible guy too. And he actually has a film that may have been released, or a book recently. I saw a film the night. He presented a film about him. He had a book that was published in 2016, which I didn't realize, and I'm going to have to look it up. And did you know that I worked on a bit of a documentary about genocide in Riga, Lithuania?
No, I had no idea.
Yeah, a few years ago, I was doing volunteer work at a film co-op here, and I met a guy, and he got me working on archiving his photos. Sometimes I would get home pretty bummed out. You had to really keep your head into a good space. But I loved the work, and I found out so much about Lithuania. Again, somebody might want to tell me about this, but because they had been treated, they felt they had such a bad relationship with Russia, the Soviet Union, they decided to work with Germany. And there are still unaccounted and unaddressed genocides in Lithuania. And of course the government wants to not deal with it. But the Nazi hunter, this Ephraim Zuroff, he's actually found a number of people in that area and brought them back to the country, and he's trying to bring attention to it. All very, very fascinating things. And obviously, they have an Operation Last. They have this Simon Wiesenthal, and he works for that institute. They had Operation Last Resort. I think that was called our last call to try and find the Nazis that were out there living. And, I mean, do you think that we should be addressing that? I don't know. I'm passionate that they should, even if they're old. I don't care. I've really been passionate that they need to. Do I want them murdered? No, maybe not. But I want them to be brought to attention. Plus, it keeps the dialogue about the Holocaust as real.
Sure.
So for me, that's really part of it. I know that they maybe lived good lives, but they're still driving cars. They're still viable people.
There may be less of that activity going on now just because of the distance in time at this time and how old and how many of those people have died at this point.
Definitely.
There's very, very few vets from the Second World War are still around.
Yeah, and some are, and they're in their 90s, and then people are saying, look, they're too old to do it. And, this guy that they took to Israel, when he put on the biggest show the second time he got arrested, and went to Germany, he started acting like they took him out of the house in a hospital bed in a wheelchair, and he was doing all this. And then the lawyer goes, this was a sham. We'd been filming him for a couple of days before we arrested him. He's driving his car, walking around shopping. All of a sudden, he was, invalid. And they said, guess what? And because he was invalid, they sent him back home again. Then they showed the courts that we have this footage of him yesterday documented, and they hauled him back out again. So very interesting. I think everybody would make their own decision. When I saw him, I was like, guilty as fuck. I'm not a very compassionate person. I felt like his attitude in the court was disturbing. It didn't make, he was laughing at them and smiling. And I was like, you are creepy.
I can't say that I've been watching anything so interesting over the last week. As I say, I came down with this really, really bad cold. And Sheila found some kind of Australian cooking game show that she was watching. Which is just about when your nose is running like a tap and you're just feeling like you've got nothing.
Right.
An Australian TV cooking game show is about right. But what struck me is the sameness of all of those reality shows.
Oh.
It became more apparent when you see one made in a different country.
Mm-hmm.
So what this show was about, and I forget what it was called now, but what it was about was they would feature every week the food of a particular country, and they would have a restaurateur somewhere in Australia come on the show, and he would have his apprentice, his line cook, his sous chef, and then the owner of the restaurant, the executive chef. And then you had these home cooks. And there would be a dish. They would start off with the home cooks would all cook a dish in competition with the apprentice. And then the next time they would be in competition with the line cook. And most of the time, the people from the restaurant who are doing this clearly for an advertisement, because they do like the four shows, and then the fifth show is all about the restaurant. Right? So it's just it's really a promo for the restaurant. I guess there's a few things about it which were curious. One was that in some cases, the people who were running the restaurant in Australia featuring a certain kind of ethnic food weren't of the ethnicity of the food. And I think one of them was the Vietnamese food. One of them,
Up as an issue that they addressed it?
No, they didn't address it. But they just like, here's Bob. He's the executive chef of the Vietnamese restaurant. It's like, that's really weird.
Right.
But you're looking at it from a lens of far away, right? Mm-hmm. This is another country's experience and relationship with this with this kind of food.
It's really close to, they're closer too. It's
probably
bigger influence.
There's a lot of Australian visitors to Vietnam, and there's a lot of, I think, Vietnamese restaurants in Australia. But in watching the show, you can really see, especially when you see one that's produced somewhere far away, that they all have the same production values. So they film all kinds of stuff and then they piece it together in the editing room and they add the music, and the music adds the drama. So there's always this dramatic music, and they all have somebody gets voted off the island somehow, or they have judges, and the judges, have to be real judge-like. So the premise is a little bit different than other ones, but they're really sort of all the same in a way. The Australian one that we watched was a lot less bombastic than like the Gordon Ramsay ones. And I often think, like, there's one in Canada. I guess it's Master Chef Canada, and it's got this restaurateur, is an Asian dude with blue hair. And he goes out and he'll say, your time is almost up, and that kind of thing.
Right.
And I'm thinking, this guy has studied. You know, and there's three of these chefs who are judges.
Yeah.
They've studied for years. They've perfected their craft.
Mm-hmm.
They've become excellent chefs. They've become restaurateurs. They're business owners. But they choose instead to be a game show host.
I guess it's fun.
Maybe it's fun. Maybe it's just the money. Maybe they just get...
Maybe it's the money.
Maybe you can earn a lot more money as a game show host than you can as a restaurateur. Because that business, the restaurant business is a tough business.
It's super sketchy. But then you look at Top Chef. I mean, they're... I love Top Chef on Bravo. And also, full disclosure, I do watch Survivor. I'm a devoted Survivor fan. I watched it every episode.
I still want to have Survivor, Northern Ontario, yeah, May.
I know. That's right? Not going to
happen. So they're all there and the black flies come out. Right. It's like, yeah, let's survive now.
No, they would not survive. I wouldn't survive in the beautiful Fiji that they go to because they don't have any food. So, listen, are they... I lost my train of thought. Where were we?
We were talking about Survivor, and then we were talking about game shows, Top Chef.
Oh, because I think that they still have restaurants. Don't the hosts of the show still have their restaurants? So that's why not go to their restaurant then? That's great advertising.
Well, maybe it promotes the restaurant,
their thing. And I think that's the whole increase, is that you add, you compound. It's like you compound your business. You're compounding just like we do. We say, come to Dish and Dharma, only we're not doing it for money. Well, we would take money if you do want to donate. We will take it if you're a big advertiser, but maybe not McDonald's or Instapot. Neither are going to want to advertise on our show because we've kind of mocked them. But anybody else wants to advertise, we might discuss it. I don't know if we would, though.
By the way, I have to tell our listeners that this morning I could see in Candy's kitchen, one half of the kitchen, she's got her Instant Pot. And over the other side of the kitchen, she's got this absolutely beautiful cast iron pan. Later on, I'll take a picture of the Instant Pot and the cast iron pan together.
Well, listen, I'm inclusive. I like it all. It's like all the people who had a few gods. We don't mind taking on more gods. The more gods, the better. It's only the people with one religion that they get very intense about protecting their religion. The more gods, the better.
You know, I think with those cooking game shows... The worst of the lot are the ones that the real bottom feeder shows that get
that
into the worst aspects of people's personality, you know, where they want to rip each other's hair out or, you know, and you see them like backstage and they're like smoking and they're like scheming against one another. And, I think some of them are a little bit classier than
maybe,
that.
Maybe. I mean, I'd like to know what that show is where they're back smoking and scheming.
Which one was that?
I don't know which one it is.
Was it a cooking show?
Yeah, oh, Ramsay? Oh, yeah. No, I did watch those, but I don't remember that. They did get a little more nasty. You're right. They did scheme.
Yeah, because they were in teams, right?
There's an element.
They were in different teams,
yes,
and the teams had to beat the other teams. Yes. And then the team that lost... had to do, like, you have to peel 10,000 potatoes.
That's right. I do remember that.
Scrub the kitchen.
I haven't watched it for a while.
Or do something that's, like, totally
demeaning. Right, I forgot about that. They did, yes.
And it really suggests, it tells you that a chef's life is, a cook's life in a restaurant is a shitty life. It's a life in which you're subservient to the chef and you're always going, yes, chef, yes, chef.
Yes.
Does that happen in restaurants?
Sometimes we'll say it for fun. I don't know. Yeah, I think they do. I think it depends on it. And I think sometimes it can be for fun. Oh, speaking of another cooking show, if we have time, I don't know. I know you didn't like it, but I really loved it. And I think it was The Chef Show, done by Jon Favreau, who did the movie Chef, and I enjoy it immensely. I love David Chang, and I love... I forgot the other guy's name. I feel terrible. I'm going to have to find that, too, because I just went blank. But I love it. And they talk about their families and their home cooking, and they're making these recipes. In one episode, the guy that grew up in San Francisco, his mother made kimchi for the whole neighborhood.
That's based on the movie Chef, right?
Yes,
which about the
he
food
enjoyed
truck.
It so much. Jon Favreau enjoyed being
cooking. He wanted to continue a living off that concept.
I think so, and I think it's more than making a living. I think it's make more experience. I think it is about making money.
I lasted half an episode,
by
the way,
you
listeners.
Did not like it. That's okay. But I do recommend it. I thought they were super charming.
Lest you think that Candy and I agree about everything.
We do not agree.
There are a few things we don't agree on. That's one of them.
Yeah. I really loved it. Okay. But moving on. We've done Nazis and Nazi hunters and cooking shows. There we go. How are we doing? Should we wrap it up?
I think we should wrap it up.
All right. Okay. And we've enjoyed. How did you like the tea room?
Well, the tea room is fantastic. The Shadow Emporium. It's a great place if you're in Pilsen.
Yeah.
Come here and have tea. It's a really super spot. Also, it's great to be in Chicago.
Yeah.
Thanks for hosting me here in Chicago.
Oh, very happy.
And we're going to try to do some more, at least one more episode.
Yeah, at least a mini episode, should we say. It's with Steve Rosen, who teaches at Old Town
School. And is a banjo player.
From the vlog?
Volo Bogtrotters.
Thank you.
Banjo player, guitar player, fiddle player, mm-hmm. mandolin player.
Singer.
Extraordinaire.
And a great fisherman, all-around guy.
Oh, yeah. Great all-around guy. Loves trains, too. Mm-hmm. We're going to be talking about trains.
Yep. Steve, we're going to go out for dinner with him, and that'll be our next. This is the first time we know what our next episode is going to be.
That's right. And who knows, we might even record more while I'm here in Chicago. You just never can tell.
You never can tell. Thank you for listening. We really appreciate you. Please email us. Send us topic suggestions. Send us shows to watch. I'll watch them. Hell, I watch Survivor. I'll watch anything.
And we'll... soon.
That's right. Thank you.
Bye.